Security Council because there are many countries that are yearning to be liberated from the Western hegemony. The events that the world is witnessing in some African countries are a clear proof for this desire for change.
On Thursday, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, the leader of the Ansarullah movement, criticized the US and the UK for exploiting the humanitarian situation in Yemen. He slammed them for threatening to cut the UN-provided aid to Yemenis in order to stop the country's naval operations. Al-Houthi asserted that, according to the US officers, the American Navy has not faced such a humiliation in the international waters since the 19th century.
Neither the military aggression against Yemen nor the cessation of the supply for humanitarian aid has succeeded in halting Yemen's naval operations. Furthermore, officials state that the ongoing Western aggression only serves to motivate the Yemeni army to continue enhancing its capabilities. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
In a fervent display of solidarity with the oppressed people of Gaza, a high-profile event dubbed Palestine Freedom Conference was convened in the capital, Islamabad. Political leaders, scholars, and representatives from various advocacy institutions gathered at the conference to condemn the ongoing Israeli atrocities in Gaza and to advocate for the rights of Palestinians.
The United Nations role is getting more and more important. But we see that United Nations is going on the agenda of Israel and the agenda of America. They are not doing their good efforts to stop this war. Besides stopping the war, they are provoking the war. They are supporting the war. United Nations should take important steps to stop this war.
The event was aimed at amplifying voices against the relentless Israeli attacks on unarmed civilians in Gaza. Scholars and experts also slammed global powers for their role in perpetuating the ongoing genocide and supporting the Israeli regime.
We are not expecting much from the United Nations. More than 3,000 innocent men, women and children have been killed. But the UN has no courage to stop Israel from doing these inhuman acts in Gaza. Muslim leaders have taken no effective step for a ceasefire in the besieged territory. They should feel shame for their silence on this massacre.
The gathering denounced Israel's military aggression against Gaza and emphasized the importance of upholding the international humanitarian law. The conference underscored the urgent need for international intervention to halt what it described as the bloodshed in Gaza. It also called for practical and immediate steps to alleviate the sufferings of the war-stricken Palestinians.
Participants in the Palestine Freedom Conference pledged to continue their efforts for the people in the Gaza Strip. They vowed to mobilize the support for the implementation of the UN resolution that called for an immediate ceasefire in the territory. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made a visit to the Turkmen capital of Ashgabat on Wednesday in order to boost bilateral ties between the two countries. Amir Abdollahian met with Turkmen President Sardar Gurbanguliyevich Berdimuhamedov. The Iranian top diplomat also met with his Turkmen counterpart, Rashid Meredov. During the meeting, both sides expressed satisfaction with the progressing relations between the two countries.
The volume of our trade is boosting significantly, and with the agreements we signed today, we expect a jump in our trade. We will also increase our cooperation in the field of electricity and gas.
Pursuing the memorandum of understandings assigned by the both countries' presidents in 2022 was also one of the main goals of the visit.
One of the main goals of the visit was to pave the way for Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi's visit to Turkmenistan in order to pursue the agreement signed between the two countries.
According to Iranian officials, the relationship between Iran and Turkmenistan is not just a neighborly relationship, but a relationship of brotherhood, and they seek to deepen the ties as regional policy is high on the agenda of the Iranian president's foreign policy. The Iranian Foreign Minister's visit to Ashgabat is aimed at consolidating bilateral ties. Iran and Turkmenistan enjoy good relations as two neighboring countries, and now Tehran and Ashgabat are planning to further boost their relations in various fields, including trade and economy. Farzan Ashuryun, Ashgabat.
In the holy month of Ramadan, and as part of its commitment to Al-Quds International Day, the Islamic Republic of Iran, via its embassy in Damascus, has distributed several tons of humanitarian aid among Palestinian refugees and resistance factions in Syria. The convoy included essential food kits as a gift from the Iranian nation.
The Islamic Republic of Iran and the Axis of Resistance stand by the oppressed Palestinian people in the face of the Western and American support for the Israeli entity, which has not ceased its crimes against the Palestinian people in Gaza. Today's gathering comes within the framework of supporting the resilient and patient Palestinian people.
This gift is part of a series of annual donations offered by the Islamic Republic of Iran to Palestinian refugees during the month of Ramadan in several Syrian cities. According to Palestinian officials, this large amount of aid delivered by Iran is a message of solidarity with and commitment to the Palestinian cause.
This is a significant step within the framework of Iran's support for the resistance of the Palestinian people. This support has been reflected in all forms and means since the victory of the Islamic Revolution under the leadership of Imam Khomeini, may God rest his soul, and whose legacy continued with the leader Imam Ali Khamenei. Therefore, we as Palestinian people and resistance factions appreciate this gift and everything that the Islamic Republic is providing.
The Palestinian factions expressed their gratitude to the Islamic Republic of Iran for this gift that is presented every year to the Palestinian people.
This aid provided by the Islamic Republic of Iran during the month of Ramadan to the Palestinian people is considered as proof of Iran's great role and the interdependence between the Iranian and Palestinian people. These activities confirm the loyalty of the Palestinian people to the Axis of Resistance, in addition to the fundamental and strategic role of Syria and Iran in the Axis of Resistance.
With this humanitarian aid, Iran demonstrates that true support lies in actions rather than words, and it reflects the enduring place of the Palestinian cause in every Iranian's heart.
This gift is not only a gesture of love from the Iranian leadership and people. More importantly, it underscores their unwavering commitment to help their Palestinian brethren wherever they are. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Pensioners rallied in hundreds of towns and cities in France against President Emmanuel Macron's determination for even more austerity cuts amid the inflation crisis. When campaigning in 2017, Macron promised he wouldn't cut pensions and that their purchasing power relative to inflation would be preserved. 7 years later, inflation has progressed 17%, while pensions have been increased just 8%. Along with his widely protested pension rollback and age hike by decree in 2023, the gap between inflation increases and pension increases may explain why perhaps no sector of society has turned against Macron more than retirees.
Think about it. How is an elderly pensioner who is largely stuck at home and unable to work is supposed to make up this gap? Now add in the increases we all see in food, heating, and electricity prices, and you can see why pensioners are so upset with Macron.
Oh, on n'est pas malheureux.
I'm active in senior citizen politics, and several years back, many pensioners would not be interested when we would distribute information leaflets to them. They'd say things like, oh, we're not unhappy, or others are poorer than us. But I can report that in recent months, no pensioner is saying that or refusing our help. That's how bad it's gotten in France, and especially in the quality of our healthcare.
Paris has warned there will soon be a second round of austerity cuts to the already austerity 2024 budget.
There are so many retirees who live on less than 900 euros per month, and everyone should be able to comprehend how difficult that is. Many of us have also diseases like cancer and diabetes, and I can promise you that none of us asked for them. We deserve dignity, and not to be treated like we are some sort of lower class citizen just because we have finished our working career.
An alternative to public service cuts would be increased taxes on the rich or corporate shareholders. But the Macron administration said it doesn't want to go digging into the pockets of the French. As the average household is still reeling from COVID and the disastrous backfiring of Europe's sanctions on Russia, a report from Oxfam found that France's billionaire families have gained 230 billion euros since 2020. That's enough to give a check of 3,400 euros to every single French person. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
To mark the National Day of Resilience and the 9th anniversary of the Saudi-led war on Yemen, Yemenis have organized multiple events across the country. This year, they are also expressing their support for the people of Palestine as Israel carries out a genocide in the Gaza Strip. Several high-ranking officials participated in these events.
Today, we celebrate the steadfastness and standing up against an aggression that has continued for years. We are defending ourselves and resisting politically, economically and militarily in the face of the barbaric aggression in which the whole world has allied with, and a siege that is still in place. Although 9 years have passed, the aggression is still ongoing and the siege has not stopped. Therefore, we will continue to stand together until the war stops completely.
Officials state that the Saudi-led war continues despite failing to achieve its stated objectives. They argue that the U.S. does not want the war to end, aiming to subdue the Yemenis, especially after Yemen began its naval operations in support of Palestine.
There are lots of agendas that were not achieved by the war in Yemen, and therefore America wants to at least reach the rest of its goals regarding Yemen. But the truth is that a Yemeni victory has been achieved, and we have imposed our presence. We united in political, military, and social level, so Yemen succeeded in absorbing the strategic transformations, imposing itself in the Red and Arabian Seas, and supporting the Palestinian cause. America has no choice but to accept this reality.
In the meantime, the spokesman for the Yemeni army reported 6 military operations over the past 3 days. These operations included targeting 3 American and British vessels with missiles and drones in the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea, while another vessel heading to Israeli-occupied ports was also hit. The Yemeni army also launched an attack on 2 U.S. destroyers. Yemeni forces also successfully struck the occupied territories with ballistic missiles.
After 9 years of U.S.-backed war and siege, observers believe that Yemen today is stronger than ever, being the only country to have supported Palestine through military action. They argue that Yemenis are confident they are on the right path as long as Washington continues to bombard and terrorize them. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
For more than 170 days, the Israeli operations in the besieged Gaza Strip have resulted in the deaths of more than 32,000 individuals. The latest incident involves an attack on Al-Shifa Hospital, where witnesses have reported extensive atrocities. In reaction, Iranians assembled in front of the Turkish embassy on Monday to voice their indignation.
People gathered here to condemn Israeli genocide in Gaza, urging Muslim states, including Turkey, to halt exporting energy to the regime.
Participants lament that the international community has thus far remained silent regarding Israel.
We as women have come here with our children because we witnessed the Israeli action against Palestinian women and children. Sadly, the international community has remained silent.
Regrettably, Turkey as a Muslim nation exports significant raw materials, including metal, to Israel. If Turkey were to cut off this supply and prevent exports to Israel through the Ceyhan port, it would exert considerable pressure on Israel. We also call on other Muslim countries, like Azerbaijan, which supplies 40% of Israel's oil, to cease their support.
This plea follows Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, leader of the Islamic Revolution, urging Muslim nations to cut political and economic ties with Israel. Protesters also cited Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, who highlighted the role of Muslims in opposing Israel by saying, "If the Muslims of the world united and each poured a bucket of water, Israel would be washed away." Farzan Ashuryun, Tehran.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
On Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O patron of beneficence.
Bring us on from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
In 73 days of U.S.-Israeli genocide confirmed by UN experts, over 32,500 murdered, over 100 deaths repeatedly occurring during 24-hour time spans. Yet one of the only achievements of the so-called international community is for the U.S. to abstain from a resolution for a temporary ceasefire instead of a veto, widening the U.S.-Israeli spat. Ceasefire talks have hit a dead end, one after another, with each side blaming the other, though it is clear that the Israeli regime is the one committing the genocide. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at things like Israel's international isolation, humanitarian issues like the controversial U.S. airdrops, amongst many others, and the Yemeni army's continued targeting of Israeli-bound vessels, including ones from the U.S. and the U.K. First, let me introduce our guests. Saad Nimr, professor of political science at Birzeit University, joins us from occupied Ramallah. Also joining us is Fahima Mohammed, who's a broadcaster and TV presenter from London. Welcome to you both. Saad Nimr, let me first start with you and get your reaction on what the UN expert Albanese has said. She's a UN special rapporteur on the rights situation in the Palestinian territories, Francesca Albanese. Quote, there are reasonable grounds to believe that Israel has committed the crime of genocide against Palestinians. Israel has committed three acts of genocide with the requisite intent. Well, what's your reaction to that?
Well, that was this morning in the session of the United Nations Security Council, as well as the United Nations General Assembly in many cases, and on that it was also in Palestine. And she addressed the audience with this statement. It is about time. Now, when we are talking about organizations, most of the organizations around the world are admitting that there is a genocide in many accounts, not only three as she mentioned, but even more. But this is a view of their investigation to talk about, you know, three kinds of genocide and war crimes in Gaza. Everyone knows now, and even after the ICC also ruling about, you know, the Israelis that should commit and not to commit any kind of genocide, it is a kind of admission that there is a kind of genocide going on. And now we are waiting to see what would follow in the ICC. However, it's not now about that the whole world do know that there is a genocide and there is war crimes one after another in every day on a daily basis. It's not that the most important thing. The most important thing, what the international community or so-called international community going to do. They are doing nothing apart from, you know, these statements. We heard many statements from so many people in sure. positions, including Guterres himself. But so far, there is no action being taken in order to stop Israel from this genocide or to force Israel to stop the genocide and the war crimes committed against the Palestinians.
Well, Fahima Mohammed, one of the things that occurred was at the UNSC. Well, for the first time, there was a Gaza ceasefire resolution. This was because the U.S. abstained. There were previous attempts where the U.S. vetoed. But some are saying that's a little too late. It's just a political win where it emphasizes and kind of puts weight on what our guest there from Ramallah said, that these are just statements and words overall. I mean, we're looking at 32,000 Palestinians that have been killed.
First of all, why do you think the U.S. went for that? And if you think it's too late for something like that in this stage, at this stage of the game, and if there is a ceasefire, then why aren't other countries moving to implement it and doing something about it?
I think in addition to what our guests have just mentioned, I think everyone can see now that in the context, there have been several international laws and principles that have been violated. And because also the journalists are still not allowed into Israel to actually comment and counter whatever has been done. So then it only is left for people to understand that what they've been seeing is the violence, which is continued attacks on the civilians, the infrastructure, the hospitals, which is the international human rights law. Then we've got the Geneva Conventions as well. The fourth Geneva Convention addresses the protection of civilians at the times of war. And as we can see, that it basically has got nothing that they are doing in attempt to actually save or, you know, give them any sort of way out of Rafah when there are statements directly from Netanyahu to actually enter. So these are another violation of these provisions, which is evident, and people are very concerned. We've also got the UN Charter, which prohibits the threat and use of force against territorial integrity or political independence of any state. So the aggression, as again, is continuous. And then we've got the customary international law, again, which in the Palestinian context prohibits, you know, genocide. And with the UN now stating that, of course, there are evidence for that. And again, the international criminal law stating the genocide being accountable under this international criminal law includes the deliberate targeting of civilians and systematic violence. So I guess these kind of adoption and principles are now being seen worldwide, and the pressure politically is definitely there, but nobody's implementing it because it's always been lip service. And the port that's being built is even made from the rubble. So they are trying different ways, and even UN spokesmen have said that they are, you know, trucks miles away, you know, basically there to give the aid, but just not being entered. So again, we can see that there is still support for the continuous bombardment and genocide that's happening, and nobody is actually taking any action, like you said. And the reasons being is because there's probably too much at stake for what is the end goal and their own propaganda and agenda for the actual land in Gaza.
Indeed. Well, we're looking now at what appears to be this rift, said number, which has different dimensions to it. I'm not too sure if we can call it a rift, because in words, it's one thing, in action, it's another. But one aspect of it is this U.S. abstention, where it is pretty significant in terms of the way that has not only been done, but the way it has impacted this relationship between the U.S. and Israel. What do you think about that? Because we hear, of course, the delegation that was canceled by Israel to travel to the U.S., even though their military chiefs did meet. And Netanyahu also said this cancellation is a message to Hamas in terms of the way we are dealing with the U.S. But nonetheless, what's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I think that the United States were sending a message also to Israel by this, situation in the Security Council. And particularly this message is to Netanyahu. It's quite clear that now there is a kind of a campaign in the United States to separate between Israel and the relationship between the United States and Israel, which is a solid kind of relationship, and they are committed to Israel, and they are going to continue supporting Israel. Today there was a meeting, you know, to discuss the operation to Rafah. So the Americans are still participating in this war, and they are again going on with Israel on the strategic level. However, there are some problems between the administration and Netanyahu or the government of Israel. What the Americans are trying now to do by meeting Gallant alone and meeting Gantz alone, ministers in the government, or the Israeli government, it means that they are trying, you know, to push down Netanyahu, and they are saying quite clearly that it's Netanyahu is acting on his own interest rather than the interest of Israel. They are still committed to help Israel and to support Israel in all accounts, but at the same time, they want to send this message to Netanyahu, knowing by the end of the day that even this resolution being taken yesterday, it's not going to be implemented, because Israel is not going to implement it. When did Israel implement any of the United Nations resolutions? We are talking about more than 1,000 resolutions in between the Security Council and the General Assembly, and Israel did not comply with even one single resolution. So the Americans do know that, and they know that they are going to support them if there were some pressure going on by other countries, like the Colombian president said that we should start boycotting Israel if they did not comply with the resolution. This is a good gesture by the Colombian president, but at the same time, let's see other countries what they are going to do and how they are going to implement and force Israel to cease fire and so stop this aggression and this genocide against the Palestinians. I think that the Americans and Israeli do know that Israel is not going to comply.
Well, here's the problem. I don't know if you may see it this way or not, Fahim Mohammed, is the fact that you have the U.S. all-out support when this Operation Oslo Flood started. You have these four previous times that they came and they used their veto. But each time that they're doing that, you have hundreds of thousands of Palestinians that are being murdered, finally getting to the point where they abstain. And then you have, for example, the U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin saying civilian death toll is far too high and the amount of aid is way too low, far too low. Palestinians are dying as a result. And our guests there said the U.S. is continuing with its support. Palestinians are dying. People are losing their lives. This, if you take that out of the context of what's happening, that's what the end result is. There needs to be a way to speed things up. How do you see it?
I just think it's just showing and highlighting the U.S. hypocrisy in Gaza, the U.S. Secretary of Defense's acknowledgement of civilian casualties and insufficient humanitarian aid in Gaza highlights a discrepancy between the rhetoric and action, and the continued military support to Israel amid civilian casualties raises questions about the U.S. policy coherence and commitment to human rights principles. And I think that at the end of the day, it's a political battle as well with regards to the upcoming elections, as well as in the US, as well as in the UK. And I think a lot of people are just trying to submit to some of the narratives that people are, you know, abiding by the uproar of the protests. And obviously, most people are now on the side of the Palestinians. So they're just saying what they need to say. But in the end, the action is definitely not there. And again, you know, it's no point delivering and surrounding all this aid. And at the same time, the aid is actually killing some of the civilians as well while they're distributing it off the air. And at the same time, you know, facilitating and delivering to ensure that they are still providing the military aid. So it's very much a hypocrisy.
Let's take a look at these controversial airdrops, said number, which is another controversy, where you have 18 people who have drowned, several killed in stampedes, from what we understand. Again, it goes back to the fact that you have the airdrops, which shows the U.S. intention that it actually cares, but yet you have supplies, arms, etc., that are being military supplied to the Israeli regime.
And I think that this is, you know, the biggest scam we ever heard of by the United States and Israel. Israel will allow Jordanian, Emiratis, and American aeroplanes to fly over Israel to send aid to Gaza, but the American can't pressurize the Israelis to open the gates and the crossings, especially not only Rafah, but we are talking about, you know, more than five crossings between Israel and Gaza, which they used to bring goods through it, more than 500 trucks every day. That was before the 7th of October. Now, America can't even open one or two of those crossings and allow more aid to get in. especially that the aid is piling up on the other side of the Rafah crossings in Egypt. So it's already there, but the access is not there because of the Israeli regulations and the Israeli, you know, banning of the aid to come into Gaza. Now the Americans are sending these kind of airdrops, but at the same time they can't force the Israelis to open one of those crossings. It's unbelievable. I think it is a kind of a scam, or the Americans want to show around the world that we are trying our best and we are helping and, you know, getting food to the Palestinians who are starving and dying of starvation, especially north of Gaza. And we are doing our best in the humanitarian issue. And they are trying, you know, to show that they are these kind of good guys. At the same time, they are the one who are giving the Israeli the ammunition and giving them the rockets and giving them the all kind of supplies of to continue this war. And we know that they can stop the war, and we know that they can force Israel to open more crossings. So I think the whole thing is just, you know, a kind of a charade in front of the international community to say that we are doing our best, and in the future they will say we helped. We tried, right, and we gave them, you know, some food here and there by air droppings.
Okay, this rift thing between the U.S. and Israel, however, in one respect, seems to be serious, Fahima, where we take a look at, for example, how there was a news source a week or more ago that said this military operation in Rafah, were Israel to go ahead with it, would lead to a shift in U.S. policy. We're looking at one shift that happened at the U.N., the other being the military assistance yearly of the U.S. to Israel. If we've seen the shift at the U.N., do you think the other is going to come?
I think the potential shift in U.S. policy is possibly a significant shift in U.S. policy in response to just Israel military operations in Rafah, reflects the growing international scrutiny of Israel's actions and their consequences, not necessarily what they actually would really do. So conditioning of military assistance could serve as a leverage point for influencing Israel's behavior. But again, to what extent do they have that power over Israel? Or are they still just, again, it's lip service, smoking screens? And again, just like our guest has mentioned, it's just, you know, saying and covering themselves to say we have tried our best so that they are not held accountable. But in the end, they have no control over Israel to make them do whatever they're doing. They're just only there as an ally to give whatever support and at the same time to cover themselves when it comes to any kind of future international kind of criminal investigation. And I think that's what they are actually doing. But obviously, there is so much that can be done that they're not doing. And it's not just the allies, it's also the surrounding countries as well. So there has to be accountability and responsibility, not just for the Western world, but also in the Middle East as well.
Yeah, talking about surrounding countries and this criminal proceedings that may actually involve other countries, there has been a somewhat of a contagion when it comes to stopping arms shipments to the Israeli regime. Canada has halted the arms sales to Israel. Sad number. We're looking at Denmark and Italy to have already suspended their arms exports. The Netherlands maybe has ruled the government to do the same. British Parliament, for example, some parliamentarians are calling on the government to put an end, even though the number of MPs is still not enough. What do you think about this trend? Do you think that this is something that's going to involve other countries as well?
Yeah, I think that the public in Europe and in other countries around the world who were going into demonstrations in support of Palestine and try to put an end to the Israeli aggression started to get some results here and there. Well, if you remember, we talked about many times about, you know, the results of this war, and we said there are some changes occurring, and we said that changes on the international level, it will be slow a little bit, but sometimes it might be even much better. Now, I think few countries are starting, you know, to take some actions, and I believe this is a turning point, important point, for the future, to get out from the circle of America, because we know that the Europeans generally, and European Union as an organization in itself, they follow the Americans totally, and they agree with what the Americans are doing and the policies of America, whatever. So to see that few countries here and there is starting to act alone, and now we are hearing also that there are few countries in Europe who are willing to start and initiate recognition of Palestine as a full state, and that is also important, and they are breaking away from the mainstream policies of United States. Yeah, it is the pressure of the people. It's the pressure of the people which, you know, get these governments to start, you know, thinking differently. That might, you know, make the changes on a longer term, not on a short term. Short term, we can see only these few countries here and there who are willing, you know, to do something and to take action. But I was also amazed today with 120 parliamentarians in UK taking this decision, you know, or talking about, you know, stop sending weapons to Israel. Though, as you said, it's not enough, but at least this is a great move which we never anticipated before. Canada, which is an important ally to the United States, Italy, Spain. Okay. So we are talking about few countries, even in Europe or even in America, North America. They are trying, you know, to get somewhere, because the pressure is coming from their own public, and this pressure was a genuine one and really a big one, and it started to do some effect. We hope that other countries also will follow in the same lines.
There are some questions about whether this is just, again, to impress the international community, because some of these export permits, is said the approval prior to January 8th will still go through with them being delivered. Nonetheless, because of lack of time, we need to move to the successful campaign that the Yemenis have executed. Fahima Mohammed, if you can tell us about the way that this has actually surprised many, and it does remain a successful campaign, and unfortunate that Yemen is one of the only Arab countries to really stepped up to the plate and done what it has. What's your impression of the way that they've gone about this?
Yes, the Yemeni army's targeting of vessels bound for countries supporting the Saudi-led coalition reflects its efforts to disrupt the blockade and draw attention to the humanitarian crisis in Palestine as well as in Yemen. And the linkage between targeting vessels and ending the blockade highlights the Yemeni's government's strategic objectives. And I think it has actually created a huge international uproar, and it has actually even made certain countries to actually back off a little bit, because it is going to affect trade and economics, you know, tremendously. So again, it was a huge wake up and a huge effort from Yemen. And I think that that was quite brave. And for that to continue, in a way, did actually wake up the international community a little bit more than they expected to actually respond.
And to end the program, the ceasefire talks, I believe, is a good way to put into a question to you, Saad Nimr. What is going on there? At this point, it is maybe becoming a reality that the camp that says Netanyahu doesn't want a solution, because that would mean the end of his political career. Do you think that that's true?
Exactly. That's very much true. He knows that the moment that they ceasefire and stop the war, it means the defeat of Israel in its war against Gaza, providing that they said from the very beginning that they are going to eliminate Hamas and the Palestinian resistance and to release all the prisoners, and they failed in doing that. So it is a victory to the Palestinians, and it is the second victory after the 7th of October. This is on the one hand. So Netanyahu, he don't want to stop the war, and he don't want to go to any kind of deal with the negotiations, and he continued to put obstacles in front of this negotiations in order to make the war longer and longer, and he don't care about the prisoners, in spite of the fact of these demonstrations going on in Israel by the families of these prisoners. Still, Netanyahu, he prefer his own personal interests interest rather than the interest of Israel. All the parties in Israel are pressurizing also for these negotiations, including the not only the opposition, but also in his government. But yet, the other side of his government, the right wing, like Itamar Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, they are, you know, encouraging him to go on with the war and not to go for these negotiations. And Smotrich, he said it, I don't care about the prisoners, I care about occupying Gaza.
Thank you very much, Assad Nimr, Professor of Political Science, Brzezet University, from occupied Ramallah. And Fahima Mohammed, thank you so much, broadcaster and TV presenter from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Batawe and the team, it's goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Near 100 soldiers who served in the British Armed Forces in Iraq may have been exposed to a toxic chemical while posted to guard the Ramat Ali water treatment plant near Basra in 2003. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Sky News has covered this story and tells us more. Iraqi war veteran Andy Tosh points to his nose where he was treated for skin cancer and shows the red marks on his hand. He says his health has been permanently damaged not by baking heat of the Iraqi desert, but by a toxic chemical at an industrial site he was ordered to guard. The 58-year-old former Royal Air Force RAF sergeant says, it's clear British troops were knowingly exposed to dangerous chemicals. Sky News can reveal that nearly 100 British troops may have been exposed to sodium dichromate while guarding the Ramat Ali water treatment plant in 2003. 10 British veterans who guarded the plant have now spoken publicly about their ordeal and say they feel betrayed by the British government after struggling with a range of health problems, including daily nosebleeds, a brain tumour, and three who have been diagnosed with cancer. Described as a deadly poison, sodium dichromate is a known carcinogen. According to the former British serviceman, the ground at Ramat Ali was covered in it. Britain's Ministry of Defence claims it is willing to meet the veterans to work with them going forward, but the former troops say they want answers and accountability. Lord Richard Dannett, former chief of the British General Staff, called for a proper investigation into what happened. He told Sky News, and if the health of some of these service people have been affected, then I guess there probably is a case for at least medical support, if not financial compensation. In the opening months of the Iraq War, around 88 British troops were deployed to Ramat Ali, providing an armed guard detail round the clock. Located near Basra in southern Iraq, Ramat Ali was built in the 1970s to pump water through a network of pipes in order to flush out oil nearby. Wearing heavy combat gear, British soldiers endured baking 50 degrees Celsius heat in the day and listened to rocket fire from gunmen at night as they patrolled the industrial facility. What they didn't know was that the place was contaminated with sodium dichromate, a chemical used to prevent corrosion. Before the US took over the site, the water was filtered and treated with sodium dichromate to increase the life of pipelines, pumps, and other equipment. It is a type of hexavalent chromium, a group of compounds made famous by the 2000 film Erin Brockovich, which dramatized the contamination of water around a California town. Members of the military described how thousands of bags of the orange powder were kept in a building with no roof, some of them ripped open, exposing their contents to the wind. Others were spread throughout the facility. Investigation by the U.S. Defense Department found service members and civilians were exposed to toxic chemicals. The report also pointed blame at U.S. contractor KBR for a delay in recognizing and responding to the hazard posed by sodium dichromate. It said KBR became aware of the use of sodium dichromate at Ramat Ali as early as 31st of May 2003. When the company reviewed an Iraqi operating manual describing the use of the chemical at the facility. According to the report, both KBR and Task Force Restore Iraqi Oil, the military group responsible for restoring Iraqi oil production, reported in June of 2003 that the site was potentially contaminated with sodium dichromate, which they recognized as a carcinogen. The plight of U.S. troops who were exposed to sodium dichromate at Ramat Ali is far better documented than their British counterparts. National Guardsmen who visited the site have become ill, leading to a formal inquiry and government support for veterans across the pond. In a high-profile court case, 12 U.S. servicemen were awarded $85 million after a jury found KBR failed to protect them from exposure to cancer-causing chemicals. Each soldier was awarded $7.1 million for reckless and outrageous indifference to their health in the trial in Oregon. However, the case was overturned after KBR argued that Oregon court did not have jurisdiction and it should be transferred to Texas. Ultimately, an appeals court decided in favor of KBR, affirming a previous ruling that the Ramat Ali veterans had not provided sufficient evidence that any health issues were caused by sodium dichromate. The former British servicemen say, "In Britain, there has been no dedicated ongoing support for Ramat Ali veterans and silence from the government. They say they feel let down and worry that they could develop cancer at any time as a result of their exposure 2 decades ago. The website of Arab News has also covered the same story and tells us more. British veteran Tim Harrison says he has experienced worsening nosebleeds in recent years, which he believes are the result of his exposure to sodium dichromate during the Iraq War. Another Ramat Ali veteran, Craig Warner, was medically discharged from the Royal Air Force after he was found to have a brain tumour, a condition his surgeon attributed to chemical exposure. Other veterans who say they have long-term health problems after being exposed at Iraq's Ramat Ali water treatment plant in 2003 include Eric Page, who has been treated for testicular cancer that had spread to his stomach lymph nodes and severe headaches. Ben Evans, whose nose had to be cauterized to stop nosebleeds. Tony Waters, whose arms itch until they bleed. Andrew Day, who has regular nosebleeds and lesions on his arms, and Darren Waters, who has a rash on his shin. And they say they're not the only ones from their squadron who have become unwell. 2 others are reported to have died, although it's not been confirmed if their deaths are related to health problems linked to the Ramat Ali site. Just one of the Ramat Ali veterans to have spoken to the Arab News is without ongoing symptoms, but he said he worries about what could happen in the future. The veterans say some who have served there may still be unaware of the exposure at all. A 2019 analysis of existing studies found that hexavalent chromium, of which sodium dichromate is a type, may cause cancers of the respiratory system, buccal cavity and pharynx, prostate and stomach in humans, and it is related to increased risk of overall mortality owing to lung, larynx, bladder, kidney, bone, and thyroid cancer. During the U.S. Senate inquiry, epidemiologist Herman Gibbs said symptoms reported by soldiers during their time at the site were consistent with significant exposure to sodium dichromate. He said it was possible that chromium could cause continuing symptoms after leaving the body, given its highly irritative nature. Now discharged from the military and 2 decades after they were posted to Karmat Ali site, the British veterans say they want the Ministry of Defence, the MOD, to take responsibility. They want a public inquiry into what happened and for the Ministry of Defence to ensure that everyone who served at Karmat Ali has been contacted and offered ongoing medical support.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Islamic Revolution Guard Corps says Israel's attack on Iran's consular building in Damascus is a result of irreparable defeats it suffered in Gaza.